Good evening, this is Mark Lynch, and this is Inquiry. My guest tonight is graphic artist Bill Griffith. He's the creator of the syndicated daily comic strip Zippy and the graphic memoir Invisible Ink, My Mother's Love Affair with a Famous Cartoonist. Tonight we're going to be talking about his latest book, Nobody's Fool, The Life and Times of Schlitzie the Pinhead. Bill, welcome to the show. It's a real pleasure to talk to you.
Likewise, Mark.
This project, when I read that you were doing this, there are very few artistic projects where the artist and the project are sort of doomed to do to be conjoined, and this is one of, I mean, it's sort of celestial in the confluence of these two aspects, you and the subject.
Well, after doing Zippy for 40 some odd years, I thought it was a time for me to acknowledge the inspiration for Zippy, which is Schlitzie the Pinhead, a real human being, the subject of my book. Because when I saw Schlitzie in the 1932 Todd Browning horror film Freaks, when I was just a mere art student before I was even a cartoonist, it kind of rearranged my molecules.
And I think we were about the same age when we saw it, yeah. And it rearranged my molecules.
Yeah, so it kind of percolated in the back of my brain for all those decades. And once I connected to two specific people who actually knew and worked with Schlitzie and were still alive and able to be interviewed, then the book really began to take form.
Now, how did you begin to research this? Because of all the marginalized people, people who work in freak shows have to be the marginalized of the marginalized. And trying to piece together this information has to have been amazing.
There's no direct source for Schlitzie except for these two people who did work with him. But when you go on the internet and look for Schlitzie, you do find an awful lot of material, most of it contradictory, partly because the result of the very nature of sideshows is to exaggerate and make false claims.
Right.
So
right.
You see, I read things about how Schlitzie owned apartment buildings and diamond rings. He was a millionaire living on the Riviera. You know, you have to discount that. And then when I finally talked to his best manager, who's a man, I believe he's still in his 90s, a man named Ward Hall, I had to kind of wade through his exaggerations before I could ask him, real-world questions. You know, he started saying, Schlitzie the Pinhead, the man with the brain the size of a walnut, survives now nothing but swamp grass. And
so he's doing the con that he would say on stage.
He literally did the spiel to me when I first read, when I first called him.
Oh, my God.
And I realized I had to just let him go. So once he stopped, I said, so that's very interesting, Ward. Tell me, what did Schlitzie like to eat? So I just got into these real mundane questions, and he answered every one of them. So I got wonderful stuff out of him that made Schlitzie begin to come alive. But then when I located a man named Wolf Krakowski, who is more or less my age, who spent an entire summer with the Conklin and Garrett Circus and Sideshow in Canada, touring around Canada with Schlitzie, literally rooming next to him in various hotels, going to and from work with Schlitzie in the car. And this was the opposite of Ward Hall. This was like a sensitive, thoughtful guy. He was 18 at the time, but it tells you a lot about him that he was carrying around a copy of Jean-Paul Sartre's Being and Nothingness as he as he roamed the Canadian circus route. But he really got to know Schlitzie on a very human level, and saw Schlitzie as a kind of a very special creature. And so he gave me this tremendous insight into Schlitzie as a human. I mean, after all, yes, Schlitzie was not like you or I. He had the cognitive ability of about a four-year-old child. But if you've ever interacted with a four-year-old child, you know that that's saying a lot.
Right. But I think the real tribute to you as the artist and the writer of this is that I think for the first time I got a feel for him as a person. Like I felt aspects of Schlitzie as a human being.
Yes. Well, just like a four-year-old child, he had likes and dislikes. He had fears, and he had feelings of affection. He expressed his feelings fairly well. You know, if you only rely on the one moment in the pop culture world where you see Schlitzie in person, which is his 3 or 4 minute sequence in the movie Freaks, unfortunately his words are garbled. And I asked Ward Hall about that, and Hall told me that when Schlitzie was excited or embarrassed or under stress, he would speak in a kind of slurred fashion, but when he wasn't, he would speak fairly clearly. So then I got things from Ward Hall, like, what did he say? He said, you see, all the time. That was his catchphrase.
And he had words for ducks.
Yes.
That were very
tame Robert.
I love that phrase.
Alan, and for the pigeons, it was Alan Bar Allen.
Wow.
And these are words that are clearly spoken and with great feeling and intent. So there is a kind of Zippy-like quality, of course, to Schlitzie's speech, which is somewhat disjointed from our normal ears. And I think Schlitzie and Zippy obviously have fed off each other for many years through my brain.
But the amazing thing, reading Nobody's Fool, is I didn't you bring in Zippy at certain points, but it's a different person. Zippy's like a Zen master or something different.
Yes, yeah, kind of that, and also a vehicle for satire.
Yeah.
Schlitzie is not a vehicle for anything. He's just himself.
And the story is ultimately sort of revealing about what happened to these people who were in these sideshows. Several other of the people who were in Freaks are in your book.
Yes.
Prince Randian.
Prince Randian, the so-called human caterpillar who had no arms or legs, traveled quite often with Schlitzie throughout his career, as did Johnny Eck, the so-called half boy who had nothing below the waist. And these people, of course, were featured in Freaks. So, the sideshow world was, in effect, Schlitzie's family. He was probably taken from his birth family at around the age of 9, from what I can gather, recruited into the sideshow, and never saw his family again. Now, if he had stayed with them in 1909, when he was taken, when there was no social safety net, no welfare system, would his life have been worse or better?
Yeah.
I think it would have been worse.
I bet you he would have been
hidden away.
Yeah, he would have been institutionalized probably, as he was for part of his later
actually,
life.
He wouldn't have been institutionalized in 1909, since there was no institution to put him into, really.
Wow.
But he would have been left in a dark room, would have been a shame to his family. And instead he went to a family that accepted him as an equal. And in the sideshow family world, the so-called sideshow freaks who are either physically or mentally challenged in some way, they're even more protected within that family circle. So he lived a kind of happy life up until the terrible moment when his adoptive parents, who were really his sideshow managers, at the age of 65, Schlitzie was, since his adoptive parents both died the same year, he was suddenly thrown into the Los Angeles County Hospital, which might as well have been a medieval dungeon.
Oh, my God.
Where he just sat there with no contact, with no friends, with his world completely gone, and he couldn't understand why. And there he basically went into a kind of a catatonic state. I think he would have died there, but after about 7 months, the strangest thing happened, which was the sword swallower who he had befriended over the decades, a man named Bill Unks, was working as an orderly in the hospital in the off season. He heard kind of murmuring from a room that he was about to clean. He opened the door and found Schlitzie. He couldn't believe it. And Schlitzie fell into his arms. Unks then recruited or called his most recent sideshow manager, a man named Sam Alexander, And between them, they went into the administrative offices of the hospital and convinced them to let Schlitzie out under their care. And he went right back on the sideshow and lived a very happy number of years until he died.
It's an amazing story. And did you have to fill in certain parts? Because I can't believe all of it's known.
No, I adopted the fly-on-the-wall approach. So I did a lot of research. I did due diligence. I acted like a journalist. But then I invented based on research, I invented scenes that I couldn't have actually found literally. So, I mean...
Well, there's scenes where you're sort of privy to inside the mind of Schlitzie just briefly.
Right, well...
And I find those fascinating because it's totally un-understandable.
Yeah. Well, those insights that I had in that regard came from this man, Wolf Krakowski, because that's what he saw. I mean, I did a book about someone I couldn't have ever met, but yet I had this intimate portrait from Wolf.
Wow.
So I let that awareness filter into how I depicted Schlitzie and how I thought he might have spoken and what he might have thought. I invent a scene where he has a dialogue between two beatniks.
Right.
Who just wander up into his tent sometime in the 1950s. And, you know, they both kind of trade non sequiturs with each other. Like they're playing, you know, improvised jazz instruments with their voice. And a lot of those things I got through talking to Wolf Krakowski.
Well, there's another several of these scenes are very cinematic in the way that you portray them in the book. Another one that which for me was just amazing is that he gets cruelly heckled by this Charlie Chase.
Yeah, I made that up, but I don't like Charlie Chase.
No, he's an ass.
He's a hack. He's like a not a third rate, like a 300th rate Charlie Chaplin. And the friend of mine, cartoonist friend of mine, recommended Charlie Chase to me many years ago that I should check him out. And as soon as I got through half of one of his episodes, that was enough. He's so awful in every way. And he comes across as cruel. You know, you can kind of detect cruelty in people, even if they don't display it openly. So when I thought who would be a good person to, you know, to heckle Schlitzie, based on information I'd gotten mostly from Ward Hall, I just picked him. He just came into my head, you know. And so there he is. He's in the book. Luckily, he's long gone, so he can't sue me for anything. But Ward Hall also gave me the insight into what happened in a more real world sense when Schlitzie was tormented. And that was that, for instance, if he was tormented by teenage boys who would occasionally throw lit cigarettes at him, I asked Ward Hall, what would he do then? And he said he would drop to the ground, to the stage, on all fours, and crawl to the edge of the stage, stare at his tormentors, and say, "You see? You see? You see?" Until he, and here I'm doing air quotes, he literally freaked them out.
Wow.
And when that happened, Ward said, when the torment was going on, the audience would kind of be with the tormentors. But when Schlitzie did his response, they turned on the tormentors as a group. And then the tormentors would go screaming out the sideshow tent. So...
You're listening to WICN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. My guest tonight, always a pleasure to talk to him, artist and graphic artist Bill Griffith, creator of the syndicated daily comic strip Zippy and the graphic memoir Invisible Ink, My Mother's Love Affair with a Famous Cartoonist. But today we're talking about his latest book, Nobody's Fool, The Life and Times of Schlitzie the Pinhead. Bill, I have to ask you, as a person who's mastered the short form doing the syndicated strip, What's it like as an artist to do the long form?
It's something I've been repressing for a long time without quite realizing it. You know, when I first started doing comics back in the underground comics days in the early 70s in San Francisco, I would routinely be doing, you know, 5, 10, 20-page stories.
And I love those stories. I was one of those people that bought those books, Young Lust, you were featured in, and right. other titles. And your work was great, but it isn't the long, long form.
It isn't. Well, the long, long form didn't quite exist back then. It wasn't until Art Spiegelman's Maus
right.
in 1986, where he revived the graphic novel form, which had existed briefly in the 1930s. It's mostly in silent form. But when I read Maus, and of course Art was a good friend, I wasn't just impressed with it. I thought, do I have one of these inside? Do I have a long graphic novel somewhere? And the answer always came back as not yet.
Huh.
You know, doing a zippy strip 7 days a week, you can imagine, takes up a big part of one's
right.
time.
You're working on deadline, too.
Working on deadline constantly. No vacations. And, you know, decades of it going by. I would occasionally do something here and there, but nothing really very long. But then when Invisible Ink, my first graphic long form, when that first was triggered as a result of a visit to my uncle, who asked me questions about my mother that I sort of dug into my memory banks for, when that happened and that book kind of just came out like as if a dam had burst.
Wow.
After it was finished, I missed doing it. I had tapped into something that had been long suppressed. So within 3 months, I guess, of finishing Invisible Ink, I started the Schlitzy book. Within no more than a month or two of finishing Schlitzy, I started a third book, which I'm doing right now.
Is that the Ernie Bushmiller?
It's a graphic bio of Ernie Bushmiller, the man behind the Nancy comic strip.
Mm-hmm. Another perfect project.
I think so. It's my favorite comic of all time, and I have access to all kinds of great primary sources, people that are still around that can talk about him. So, yeah, totally immersed in it right now.
I want to talk a little bit more about you and Schlitzy. First of all, I want to dismiss anybody who thought he founded Schlitz Beer, too. You talk about that in the book.
Yeah, that's...
It would be great if he did, but he didn't.
Yeah. In my scouring of the internet, when Schlitzy's name pops up in the 1980s, it's always connected to the fact that apparently it's believed that he was he did commercials for Schlitz beer, and that was where he got his name, which is of course absurd on the face of it. It would be wonderful. I'd love to see those commercials.
Wouldn't you love to see that?
By the way, the thing about beer with Schlitzy, and the reason people made the story up. He liked beer.
That's right.
And so I remember asking Ward Hall, his last manager, I said, so, you know, did he ever get drunk? I mean, how much beer did he get? And Ward said, we could never give him very much because you don't want to see Schlitzy tipsy. He would become kind of physically out of control.
Wow.
And I said, okay, so what did you do? And he said, well, at the end of the day, we would give Schlitzy 1 inch of beer, which he looked forward to all day and was very happy with. So now, you see, there's a picture in my book, there's a page where you see Schlitzy holding a stein of beer. And if you look at the level of beer in that stein, it is 1 inch. And Schlitzy looks very, very happy. He's about to drink his 1 inch of beer. Yeah.
Now, the amazing thing is, he's in a major Hollywood movie, Todd Browning's Freaks.
Yeah.
And that just sort of adds another odd, really surreal aspect of this. And you sort of write about him meeting people like Chester Morris and Tom Mix, and they sort of intersecting in different ways.
Schlitzy's very last performance, he was introduced and hosted by Ed Sullivan.
That's amazing.
You want a real, you know,
and I remember Ed Sullivan. And
yeah. It was in 1968, I think, and
yep.
It was an indoor circus in L.A., and the ringmaster, sort of, as it were, was none other than Ed Sullivan, the man who introduced Elvis and the Beatles to America. Yeah, Schlitzie's life, you know, you could say that the sideshow is a kind of butt end of business, but still, Schlitzie's travels through that world intersected with many, many people outside of the sideshow world. He performed on the same stage, the same day as the Beach Boys in 1962. He performed in 1966 on the same day and the same stage in Toronto as the Three Stooges.
And that's with Curly Joe. Joe Derita.
Joe Derita.
Joe Derita.
Joe Derita. Yeah.
I got to ask you, as an artist, and as a person who draws himself, I loved your drawings of the Midway. Did you really get into drawing Midway and all the banners and the crowds and stuff like that? It seems like a great artistic project.
Wonderful source material, both in book form and in some private collections that I had access to. And, of course, just, you know, you put the words, sideshow Midway 1935, into the image base of Google, and you get a huge amount of material. So yeah, and I treated, you're right about saying that the book had a cinematic feel, because I consciously do that when I move the story to a new location. I like to do kind of what movies often do, which is show an establishing shot of where
right.
you are.
Right.
So in the case of various sideshows, I would literally get an establishing shot of that particular sideshow at that particular time before I would enter into the scene or the story of what was going on there.
Yeah, there's a feel, there's a flow to the book that's unique too. I mean, and it's a cinematic flow.
Yeah, well,
the story has an arc.
It does, and I teach comics, and I tell my students about the three-act story structure. Of course, you can ignore it, but it's kind of a good thing to know about when you're first writing long-form stories. And this book, without the kind of cliff-hanging end of the second act, where Schlitzie was committed to the L.A.
Right.
County Hospital, it wouldn't have quite had that that arc as well. His life is an arc.
Yeah.
Like anybody's is, but to have it had reached that point where it could have just ended tragically, and then to have a rescue scene at the end.
It's amazing.
Yeah, I couldn't have written it better if it was fiction.
I know. When I get to that part of the book, it was like the charger, the White Knight comes in, and it's like you're really rooting for him at that point.
Yeah. Well, you know. Serendipity, luck, all kinds of things happened that just made it so Schlitzie would have a nice final act.
We just have a few minutes left. One of the odd things about Schlitzie's life is when he was exhibited on these sideshows, they would always title him something weird. And you have a front piece that shows a lot of those. But the odd thing is, it was always, one of the things was the last of the Aztecs or the last of the Incas.
Yeah.
And he was often exhibited as a woman.
He was almost always exhibited as a female. And when I asked his last manager about that, he took a while for me to get past his spiel, but when he finished finally spieling again, he said, well, it was always more transgressive. It was always more forbidden for someone with a physical abnormality to be a female. When I say that, I mean to the audiences of the day, of that time.
Right.
Yeah, so to say somebody was a three-legged woman would get more attention than a three-legged man, for instance. And so Schlitzie was always billed as a female. He was clearly a male. If you were within 10 or 15 feet of him, you could see he had 5 o'clock shadow. And he was clearly male, but that was the way he was always billed, as a female. The last of the Last of the Incas, I guess, because his profile looked a little Aztec or Incan. I don't know.
It's sort of like the glyphs.
And it's also because, I mean, he was billed as a wild Australian child, for
right.
instance. So anything in those days, Australia, Incan origins, the Aztec, these were all They might as well have been Mars. They were so exotically strange to the average person.
And at the end, he was buried in what was originally an unmarked grave, but even that has a happy ending.
Yes, many years later, a group of admirers got together and got him a proper headstone. And in the book, I add a full stein of beer to the headstone.
I know, it's perfect. It's just perfect, Bill. It's amazing. Yeah. What an incredible project. My guest tonight is artist, graphic artist, Bill Griffith, creator of the syndicated daily comic strip Zippy, which I follow religiously, and the graphic memoir, which is amazing, Invisible Ink, My Mother's Love Affair with a Famous Cartoonist. But tonight we're talking about his latest book, Nobody's Fool, The Life and Times of Schlitzie the Pinhead. Bill, thank you so much for your time.
You're very welcome, Mark.
You're listening to WICN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. Good night.